This is John McGonigal with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with David Williams. David was a specialist assigned to the 57th Aviation Company as a crew chief and door gunner on a UH-1 Huey. Today is October 27th, 2015. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and David Williams is joining me by phone from Polesville, Washington. How are you this morning, sir?
I am good.
Awesome. First of all, I'd like to, while we're on the record, thank you again one more time for agreeing to participate in this interview, because I know it's a break in your normal schedule and it's a lot of work, and I appreciate that. So why don't we begin, and if you don't mind, I'd like to start with a little bit of biographical information. For example, when and where you were born, that type of stuff.
Okay. I was born in Seattle in 1946 in May. And my folks were at that time living in Seattle, North Seattle, as far as I know. I don't remember that part.
So that was post-war Seattle, 1946. I bet that was an interesting time. How long did you spend in Seattle?
I don't remember Seattle at all. I think my parents moved to Bainbridge Island sometime in that transition. I start to remember things first from Bainbridge Island. We were living next to my grandfather on a house that my dad had built on my grandfather's property. So that's when I first start to remember things. I remember when my sister immediately, younger than I, was born in 1949 or 50, I don't know, one of those years.
So how many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have one older brother and I have three younger sisters. I have a sister that's 4 years younger than I am, and then I have one that was born 57, one that was born in 64. So there's quite a spread between my sisters. My older brother and my immediate sister below me, we were kind of all together and grew up together, and the younger sisters were kind of a bit removed. So we don't remember, oh, we remember them, but it's not quite the same.
So what was life like growing up in Bainbridge Island?
Bainbridge was a small town at that time. It's still a fairly small town, but it was quite rural. We lived not in a neighborhood. We had our own kind of, we were out by ourselves, so we really didn't have neighborhood kids to play with so much. So. But it was, I remember it as a good thing. I look back on it now as a good thing also. And farm style, raised chickens and animals, cows, dogs, had a garden, and always had a place to do things outside as a kid.
So was the property a working farm?
The first one wasn't. The next one that I remember the most was a dairy farm. My dad had wanted to farm, so he started out raising chickens, and he had several hundred chickens. And that was on a 40-acre piece of property, and then he switched to raising dairy cows. So that, I think, was more prosperous for him, having the dairy cows, and the price of milk on in Kitsap County was fairly good, so that he could make a living at it. And then he chose to move to Squim later. That was more when I was a little older, and that was not good because the price of milk was not that good, and then had to pay shipping to get snow to like Seattle. That didn't work as well. The farm on Bainbridge did reasonably well, the dairy farm. But that was a nice place.
I know your brother doesn't live up there anymore, but how about your other siblings? Are they still up in that area, or are you the only one in Washington?
I'm the only one in the immediate area. I have a sister in Auburn, another sister in Carnation, and then the youngest sister is down near Tacoma. The rest of us are in the general area, yes. And Charlie has stayed down in Texas when he got out of the airport. He just stayed there.
So, if you don't mind, tell me a little bit about Mom and Dad. What did they do before they decided to have the farm and raise kids? Did they grow up in this area?
My dad was born and raised on Bainbridge Island, and he was an only child, and he worked for the Navy. It was sheet metal person. That was his the thing he enjoyed the most. He worked for the Navy, and he also had worked for Boeing Aircraft Company. And it was bits and pieces here and there. It wasn't like he started a career and finished it and started another one. He would be two or three. Of course, Boeing was at that time. You worked, and then when the jobs ran out, you got laid off, and then when they got more jobs, then you got rehired. So that's why he was going back and forth between the Navy Yard and Boeing, mostly. And then farming was kind of mixed in between. Then my mom, the only time she worked, I remember as a young kid, was she worked as a telephone operator. And that was that time when they had telephone operators. They had several of them. So if you called long distance, you had to use a telephone operator, and that's what she was. I can remember her going to work. Usually she worked evenings and different hours. It worked out fine because Pop was home during the evening, so she could work if she chose to. It was a part-time job.
Did she start doing that during the war?
She probably learned it during the war. During the war would have been before my time, so I was, after the war. That's when she filled in as we were kids, as she could. So, she had learned that. I presume it was during the war.
So in 1946, I'm kind of curious. Was there a post-war economy slowdown in Seattle? Because Boeing was a big thing. Is a big thing. Here we are in these post-war years. I was wondering how that impacted the local area.
Well, I would think that, I was so young, but there was stuff going on. I mean, we had active Navy base on Bainbridge. We had three of them. One of them was Fort Ward. The other one was Naval radio station, and those were very active. They were still active when I was a kid, so that would have been probably 10 years after the war that I would remember that stuff, 5 to 10. So that part, you still had people there doing stuff, and then they changed them to Nike bases. There was a Nike base in Eagledale and one what they called Strawberry Hill. So those were active, and then there was an active anti-aircraft facility the Army had in Yomal, which was, you know, they were living in tents yet, but they were active on the island when I was a kid. So it didn't appear things had died. It appeared that they were still going, and it was just a transition period. So they didn't have to build all of that when commercial aviation was going, so Boeing was starting to ramp up building commercial airlines. So that was a good thing for the economy.
Sure,
and
Boeing.
I can remember as kids, we were still doing watching for aircraft. I mean, what did they call it? I remember we'd go up and sight, they had this sight that you could, you identified every aircraft that flew over. And that was all volunteers, but my parents were volunteers that did that. So you'd go for a couple hours and you'd sight them and pinpoint their location and the direction they were flying and so on. There were still things going on after the war, which is kind of startling to me now to realize how close I was after the World War II.
Well, that's interesting. So it was kind of like a Coast Watcher program where you identified aircraft?
Yeah.
Wow. I haven't heard of that. I didn't realize that was a post-war activity. I would have thought that would have just ended hostilities ended.
Yeah. No, it was still going when I was a kid, so that, you know, I was old enough for me to remember that. I would have been at least 5 or 6, if not older.
Hmm.
And we were doing it then, so I would have been into the early 50s.
So, it sounds like the area you grew up is, even though it's just across the water from Seattle, it sounds like it's kind of a small town, rural environment.
Yes. And that was the plus of it. Now, of course, it's become, there's no big properties. I mean, there's very expensive properties on Bainbridge, but no large farms or any of that anymore. It's still rural, comparing to downtown Seattle, but it's essentially a bedroom community of Seattle because it takes like 30-minute ferry ride to your downtown. So if you work downtown, you can get down Seattle faster from Bainbridge than you can from commuting out, say, North Bend or Issaquah or out that way. So just simply because you get on the ferry and you're downtown. But it is nice. You get out and it's breeze and, you know, it's more rural. Real quick question.
So, as you got a little older, you got to school. What were the schools like? Were they large or small?
Well, they were small. I can remember I went to, you know, they may have had two or three grades, or classes in each grade, I suppose. And I went to, started at one grade school, and then they built another grade school out closer to where our house was, so I went to that. At each school, you'd have like one grade. So they were fine. They were okay. I was not a kid that was real excited about school. Not really real happy with school. I you know, you did all right, but I didn't do that school. I didn't do that well until I got into high school. We had shop classes and different metals classes and industrial arts classes that were more interesting to me. But, and coming from a neighborhood where you were kind of like kids, they tend to stick with their neighborhood kids when they're in grade school. Well, I didn't have any neighborhood kids to stick with, so it's kind of kind of just fend for yourself, and you're the odd man out. So pretty much that was the way it was through grade school, because my folks moved to Swim with a dairy farm, you know, when I was in the fifth grade. And of course, you were that odd person out, which I'm sure Charlie would tell you too. But then they moved back to the island when my grandmother, after she died for a year for sixth grade, and then 7th through junior high, I was back in Swim. And that's where my older brother, Charlie, graduated from high school in Swim. And he played basketball, and he was more of a student than I was. He did well. The basketball was a big thing that kept his focus. And of course, I would go and watch his games, so that was fun. Crazy stuff to do.
So you guys stuck together, it sounds like, as you, you know, because
Pretty much. We shared a room as a kid, And it was a big loss for me when he went away to college, but, you know, that was life.
And you've got, I'm trying to think, you've got 4 years between you?
4 years of what?
The age difference between you and your older brother?
Three.
3 years, okay. So yeah. you were in high school, you just started high school when he graduated?
Yes. Yeah, he was a senior and I was in ninth grade. So
what was that like? Were you one of those kids that had to walk in his shadow, or did you guys get along okay?
Oh, we got along okay. I mean, I was in his shadow. He had some of the same teachers that I did going through school, but I think they were pretty savvy on that. They realized he was different than I was. I got along with him, so it didn't bother me. I was my own self in that regard. And I was happy for him that he could do what he could do.
So you didn't have any of those teachers that were like, well, your brother understood this, how come you can't get it?
Oh, I had some, but I don't think they really said that to me. They weren't that way. They understood that I had other areas that I got along with.
You mentioned that your high school has, once you got into high school, you had these industrial arts courses and, you know, more kind of vocational type classes that were available. And it seems like that attracted you to. You were attracted to those types of courses.
Yeah, that's more where my bent was. My bent was wasn't sitting studying books and trying to figure things out that way. I was more a hands-on thing that I could learn to weld or build stuff out of wood or work on automotives. And that was a fortunate thing about my folks moved a lot, which I tried purposely never to move my kids in school, but. When Charlie graduated, my dad got work in back at Boeing, so we moved back over, and I graduated from Mountside High School, and they had a good industrial arts program there, better than Swim. Swim didn't have that, but they had, I took mechanical drawing 1 year, and then I took metal shop another year, and then I took automotive shop my senior year, so those were courses that I excelled in, and I got good grades in. You know, I could push the top of the scale in those courses. So obviously, I did learn to read, so I could, because you have to read and do math and those things. So I had learned the essentials. And they also had a good bookkeeping class in high school, which I enjoyed. You know, I can do math now, sitting down doing algebra. And geometry were not my bag, but to do bookkeeping and math, I did fine. That good grades in that. You know, it was something that I could use, you know, learning how to balance a checkbook, and how to keep track of your expenses. Something that I could see I could use and needed and is interesting. And the same with the industrial arts classes. Those are all things that I used later on in life. That was a good thing that happened in that move.
So outside of school, did you pursue some of those? Did you, you know, maybe pick up a job or something doing that type of work?
Well, I eventually became a carpenter, so yes, I certainly did. I did on the summers. I worked as a volunteer at a Bible camp over on Lake Retreat, which is south of Seattle. And I worked the summer as a caretaker's helper, so I did, you know, a lot of the woodworking part of that stuff. So, you know, it was taking care of the facilities there, so I got to do that. Again, as a summer job, I didn't get paid much for it, but still it was, you know, kept me busy in the summer. Gave me an activity to do. And of course, after I got out of high school, I went here at Bible College in Canada. And then after that year, I went to start a trade school in Seattle for a carpentry course and got drafted immediately because that's what was happening at that time. If you changed any schedule, you immediately got placed on the draft. Priority. I had about 4 months in that course and was drafted.
So you graduated high school in 64, and then you went up to Bible College in Canada, and then you came back to a trade school. What was the name of that trade school?
Well, at that time it was Edison Technical School in Seattle. And then in the time that I was in Vietnam, or in the military, they changed the name of the school to Seattle Community College, but they still have that same carpentry course there even now.
So in 1964, if we could just circle back to, you know, around the time that you're graduating high school, there's a lot of things going on. I mean, the 60s was a pretty interesting time, not only in our country, but in the world. And I was wondering, what does the high school senior talk about in 1964? Are you concerned about any of these, you know, all the things that are happening in the world with Kennedy? And, let's see, I think the Cuban Missile Crisis probably had already been averted.
Yeah, I can remember in Current World Problems my senior year, we talked about President Kennedy and the Cuban crisis and that type of thing. But, you know, that was a passing moment. You know, it had happened, and you think, oh, man, we don't want anything to happen again as far as war is concerned. We were still, of course, a bit of the age where you ducked under your desk, you know, you hid under your desk, which they don't do anymore, I don't think. But as seniors in high school, there's not a lot into that stuff. Current world problems, we discussed it because it was current world problems. You remember it happening, but not that much. But you know, we didn't do that much about it.
So I assume you were probably listening to the Beatles, maybe? Any music?
Well, yeah, it changed a lot when I was from then to into the service. It was more the music that I was not a real music I listened to the rock and roll station, but that was it. I didn't ever go to any concerts or anything. And then I didn't have a desire. I didn't have the accessibility, but I didn't really have a passion to go. But I like listening to it on the radio. And of course, then, you know, you pay attention to the news. But,
what was the number one song when you graduated high school in 1964?
Oh, I don't know. I would have to. The one I remember most is that area is the Battle of New Orleans by John Gordon.
Wow. I would have thought that would have been on the country charts.
Yeah. Oh, no. See, that was the music a lot that time was more like country music. It wasn't like the rock and roll that happened 10 years later. Most of the popular songs that we had when I was in high school, like on KJR, was a big station for kids to listen to. It was more like country music than like this other stuff they call. You know, and Elvis Presley, well, you could understand what he was saying. Some of these others you can't even understand. But.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I think Seattle, that area around there, you know, I think you can look at the things that were important around Seattle were probably pretty representative of what was going on around the country. Was anyone in your high school yet talking about Vietnam?
Yeah, we really didn't talk about that until I was out of high school. I was up in college in Canada when that was starting to happen, and we didn't get, other than some. I can remember when President Kennedy got us into that conflict or started sending people to be in that country, but my year away at school, we weren't allowed radios. Plus, that far, I was in central Alberta, so we just didn't get the information of what was going on in the war. I knew there was a war, but didn't get a lot of information then. And I don't recall hearing a lot about it, other than it was going on, even when I, you know, when I started trade school. So, it was just, I was kind of out of the loop in that regard, because in the summertime I didn't get to see any news or hear any radio, so I didn't really know anything, pay much attention to it. Other than I knew I was draft age and might have to go, but
so,
I didn't watch it on a daily basis.
So having Sunday evening dinners around the table, mom and dad weren't listening to the President Johnson ramping up the troop load or anything like that?
No, I don't recall that. There was, you know, they would see it some, and I know my mother was really kind of upset when I actually did get drafted. She said, "Oh no, they can't take you." And I said, "Well, I got the letter. I have to go," you know. And she said, "Oh, you'll be back." I was back in 2 months when I had my first leave after I'd been in basic. But
what did Dad think when you got that card in the mail?
He really didn't say a whole lot other than to keep a stiff upper lip, is what he told me. But he told me when he took me to the ferry. In other words, keep your mouth shut. And I didn't have too much trouble doing that anyway. I was about to take on anybody. Just do what you're told. And my philosophy was always kind of be as inconspicuous as possible. So that's what I kind of did in through school and actually through my tour in the military, which was, you know, I got called out on some things that they used an occasion for my Christian faith as something to try to get a laugh from other people, and I was the brunt of that several times, but that was just the way life was. So
when you got the draft card in the mail, what was the time between, you know, getting notified that you've been selected and getting on the bus and heading to basic?
Well, it seems like I had about 3 weeks, and you know, I was just notified to report to the induction station and to come prepared to not go home, is essentially what the letter said. So you have that in mind, and you don't take anything other than your toothbrush. You didn't need anything because you mailed your civilian clothes home, so you didn't even have those. So it was just kind of a, you know, you're doing what you were supposed to be doing. That's what you were asked to do, and so you didn't really have a choice, so you just kind of go with it.
Did Mom or Dad take you down there and hang out with you down there, or was it, no, you just go ahead and head down?
Oh, no, they weren't allowed to come. My dad just took me to the ferry. They were living back on Bainbridge at that time, and my dad just took me down to the ferry and put me on the ferry, and then the induction station was just a couple of blocks from the ferry dock, so I got off the ferry and walked down there and signed in. I didn't, I've heard from my one sister that all she heard about was David, of course, when I was gone. So, you know, she has memories of that where I don't. All it was me at the dinner table, so she was sick of David. I remember getting some of that because Charlie was in Okinawa when he went to Okinawa. But either they didn't hear from him, or that was usually the case when I was writing. So when I was in the service, I tried to write at least every week, no matter where I was. If I did nothing but say, hi, I'm fine, and send them a note, I figured that the least I could do was that. So.
Well, and you have actually a very, very interesting military service. And when the little bit of research that I was able to do to put this together, I was just fascinated with what you got to do. Looks like you went to basic, and then they sent you to Huey School.
Yes.
So if the helicopter was, you know, it certainly was around. I mean, it started off at the end of World War II, and it became a pretty viable platform in Korea, but it really, the whole world changed when Bell made that helicopter as far as the military mobility goes. And did you realize at the time that you were, I think they call it an RMA, Revolution in Military Affairs, did you realize that you were probably on the cutting edge of something huge when you walked into that school?
I knew it was new, and of course you learn after you get out how new it was. We were just learning it, you know. It was kind of an OJT, learning in process for the military. But you know, it was, they were going in doing rescues and bringing in troops and taking out troops. We saw pictures of that when we were in training. So when I was in basic, I had taken courses to you know, they do all their testing while you're in the first, before you even get into basic training to kind of position you in your MOS. And so I had, in basic, I was offered the chance to go to OCS. I was also offered the chance to go to flight school. And flight school was a real temptation. As I look on it now, I should have done both. But at that point in time, I remember Charlie coming back and telling me when he came back, whatever you do, don't sign up for 4 years when you can do 2 years and get out. He says, you're not going to get what you sign up for anyway. So I kind of maintained that philosophy. I figured I was drafted. I would let them put me where they felt I fit and just go for that. So I can remember only being a volunteer or following a quest of a volunteer's job just simply because I had nothing to do once. But other than that, I pretty much let, you know, them guide where I was going. So and it worked quite well. I was pleased to be, you know, in the helicopter. I liked to fly. And I enjoyed the equipment machinery. You look back on it now, you were a glorified service station attendant, and their training, they could have, it was a 19-week course that was shortened to a 12-week course because of the war, and they could have had it down to a 1-week course. And we might have been better prepared for the job that we actually did as crew chief, because you filled the aircraft, you saw that the maintenance was done well, they could have instructed you how to do that in a short period of time, and then given you about 2.5 days of training with the machine gun that you had to pack and operate and make sure it didn't jam. It would have saved them money, and it would have helped us better be prepared for what we actually did, although we learned that fairly quickly once we got in country. But we really didn't use, you know, they trained us, but taught us, you know, we spent time on jet engines and aircraft hydraulics and all of these different applications, which we never were allowed to do once we got in. They kind of spent a lot of time on stuff that was interesting. I mean, you know, and we were glad to spend time in country in school. Actually, we could have spent 2 years in school as far as we were concerned at that time, rather than go to war. But, that was just the nitty-gritty, because my first experience with my aircraft when we finally got it in the unit was the red exit. They had flown it in apparently without any crew members other than the pilot and co-pilot, and they'd flown it with the cowling cover on, so the cowling cover was sucked in around the little drive shaft in there out of the engine. So I went and got my sergeant, who was our platoon sergeant, said, you know, I've got to show you what I found. So I took him out there, and he's the one that said, yeah, go ahead and set exit. So, then I missed out on any practical in training in country. Mine was sent to the maintenance division, which was a 615, which was with us, and that was a kind of a conflict too. I wanted to figured, well, I'll help tear the thing apart and put it back together because they replaced the engine in it, and they wouldn't let me go. Says, no, that's their job, not your job. You're not supposed to be there. So they were grumbling because the crew chief was never around, and I was stuck because they wouldn't let me go around and didn't even want me to go near it. So. So it was kind of a weird thing. And then I missed, you know, they did have some practical flying in country, and I think I only flew once in back in North Carolina. And if I even flew that, and then I was all of a sudden supposed to be a Vietnam War. It was, Charlie gets upset when I say my training was very skimpy, and it just was. It was very skimpy. I did fine. Came back alive.
Well, let's go back just for a minute. Back to, I'm looking at your at the way you started. You had your basic. You started in March of '66, it looks like. And then there was no break. You graduated in May. You went right into your single-engine, single-rotor helicopter repairman school, which was, that looks like it, that was at Fort Bragg. That was at Fort Eustis, and then from graduated that in August and went straight to Fort Bragg in September. So there wasn't a lot of time. You got in and got trained and got and ended up at Fort Bragg. Did you get any time off at that point to go home?
Oh yeah, I got 2 weeks off between basic and going to Fort Eustis.
Okay.
Yeah, everybody got 2 weeks off. So yeah, you just came home and then I went to Fort Eustis. I was there, and direct from there I went to Fort Bragg, and then everybody got, I don't know, a week or two off before we left for Vietnam, but we went as a unit to Vietnam, so, and some went via ship. They took the aircraft and the motor pool and connexes all went by ship, so they got time off too, and then those, some of them went that way, and then we flew over 141 from Pope Air Base direct to Play 2.
So, if you don't mind me dragging you back, so you're 2 weeks off, just out of curiosity, was that, what was that like? Did people treat you differently, or think you changed now that you're in the Army, or anything like that?
You know, I don't remember at all anything about that 2 weeks. I just remember that I was going clear across country to school, and that was interesting to me. So. But I don't remember anything about that 2 weeks, really. The only time I remember is when I was home on leave before I went to Vietnam. An aunt and uncle were over, and the one aunt was looked at me right in the face, and she says, "Aren't you afraid to go?" And I can still remember the look on her face and her saying, and she was, you know, there's trying to be nice, but I mean, and of course you say, you know, you do what you have to do. It's not a matter of being. Are you apprehensive? Sure. You should be. There's something wrong if you aren't, I think. But afraid and, you know, you do what you have been taught to do, and you do what you got to do. And, but that, you know, even that is the only thing. Of course, my mother was. She was, I don't remember her. I know she was unhappy that I was gone and thought it was all my fault. I should have stayed in school in Canada. But I didn't feel that was my place. I felt my place was going to trade school. So, that was different, but she, you know, she handled it reasonably well. So she probably didn't with my siblings that were still at home. I couldn't protect them from her emotions, probably. With me, they were okay. They didn't want me to go. I wasn't particularly wanting to go, but I knew that's what I was supposed to do, so I did.
And Dad was handling everything okay?
He just didn't say much. Yeah.
Well.
I'm sure it bothered him, but that was, you know, he didn't say.
So you finished your pre-deployment leave and went back to Fort Bragg. this is the part that I found really interesting. You're essentially building a brand new unit, an air mobile unit that's all packed up and going as that unit forward, which I was fascinated to read a little bit of the unit history on the 57th Aviation Company in Kontum, Vietnam. Is that how you pronounced it?
Yeah. My connection is not doing well, so you're breaking up a little. I'm not sure what that is, but yeah, the building the unit was took a long time. I went to the 69th Aviation, and of course you went through a transition company, and then we spent a lot of time doing nothing, just waiting for people to get there from September through. We really didn't get serious about the unit until probably March. We started to get more people in the unit. I was probably about the 15th or 16th person into the unit initially. We had a cook was our highest ranking person in the unit when I first got in, and he was like an E3. So it was an interesting proposition, building the unit, which I know that has to happen. But, you know, you got to start someplace. And when we went to Vietnam, you of course lose part of your unit right away because they want experienced personnel in a unit. So I think it was about a third of the unit was transferred into other units. We got a third of people that had been in country for a while. That was an interesting transition. But,
so when you arrived in Pleiku, it sounded like the 141 took you into Pleiku.
We arrived in, you know, the 141 dropped us off at the airplane, and they didn't even shut it off. They just landed, opened the back door, and our immediate gear and weapons were in the back, so that was unloaded first, and a supply of ammunition, and then we were pushed out the back, and the airplane took off. We were left standing on the runway.
Welcome to Vietnam.
Welcome to Vietnam, and the smell was something else. But anyway, that was my first. Remember, you know, you're in the zone, but it was definitely a third world country, or maybe even fourth or fifth.
How long was that flight from Pope?
A long flight. I think it was 17 or 18 hours, something like that. Yeah, we flew from Pope to Fairbanks, and then from Fairbanks we flew to Tokyo. Tokyo, we flew into Pleiku.
I'm sure you didn't get any awesome layovers, go downtown in Tokyo or anything like that.
No, we weren't allowed out of the, we were just allowed to go stretch our legs and walk into the restrooms and walk back out to the plane. We were only there for like an hour and a half. So it was enough to tank up the fuel and off.
So when you loaded up in Tokyo and you knew your next stop was going to be in country, you got your unit with you. What was kind of the mood like going, you know, knowing the next stop's going to put you in country?
Oh, I mean, it was rather quiet. Everybody was rather subdued. You know, we didn't have most of our people. Had never been in a war zone before, so all, you know, apprehensive, wondering what's next. We don't know. So, yeah, you just don't really know until you get there what your reaction is going to be. It's a little uneasy.
So you're on the ramp watching the 141. Fly away. What happens next?
Well, it seems to me they brought us down. They brought us a bus, and we were all loaded on buses and taken to the base and the airfield, the air base, place for the army, and then we had to process in there. And we spent, we were filtered among some of the different units. They put us, just, we were there for a day or two. And then, you know, I don't even remember how we got to Tontoon. I don't remember how they buried us all out there, because we didn't have any aircraft. Our aircraft weren't there yet. And then we got, once you got processed, and they split us in units. So they told you who was going to stay where and who was going to go on to Tontoon. So you lost, you know, I lost a couple of my guys that had become friends with in the unit, stayed in play too. So there again, you are time off. Oh, I do. I was probably the closest with a digital industrial, just similar. He was left in Baker. So, yeah, you just, and, you know, things were quiet. There wasn't any action going right there at that spot at that moment. So, you realize, hey, you could be in a war zone. It can be perfectly quiet. You've got people working on guard duty all around. So, just hope everything was okay.
When they finally start transporting you up to your final location, were you part of the actually having to build up the location? Were they still putting together buildings and helipads and things like that?
Well, the Tontoon airfield had revetments and for aircraft to park in. It was a steel bell-shaped frame with dirt packed in the center of it, you know, metal frame. So you had a revetment where you parked your choppers. But those were there, and I think those were by the French when they were in that country. So we had places to park the aircraft, but we had just an open field. So we were building, putting up tents to live in, and building wood floors, sandbagging around your tents. Yeah, we had to build from just a flat field. We started with a flat field, and there, the advance party had already started some of that, but that's what we worked on our first few weeks in country, was just trying to build us a home there. So, and that was tents with wooden floors, and they devised a means so we could get a hot shower, and, you know, you had guard duty at night. You know, actually what it was is you were out on the perimeter with a couple of sandbags in front of you, and that was guard duty. And of course we were cautioned, be careful, because the Vietnamese locals had been walking through here, and you didn't want to kill a civilian. Well, how do you know who's coming through at night if they're a civilian or a friendly? You know, you don't speak the language. And I can remember the first time we encountered a mama song coming through, and she was just walking through on this road. Well, she probably walked through a thousand times before coming at night, and it was just dust. And so, what do? You know, your heart is in your mouth, and you wonder, man, why is he? I don't want to kill anybody, or you have a dog coming through. So, you know, you're kind of on edge, uneasy on anything. But yeah, we started from scratch, and when I left, we were still living in tents. The engineers, which were next to us, had built a wood building for a dining hall and mess hall. I worked quite a bit on that when I wasn't flying. Why the Captain Smith, who was over the mess part of the operation knew, I don't know how he found out, but that I had some carpenter experience. So any time that I had that I wasn't flying, even when I was supposed to fly sometimes, he said, requested that I work on that building shelves, and covers, and cabinets, and the mess hall for the kids. Them to use in the kitchen. So, and then another fellow and I put an addition on that to the back part for storage. So, had all the tools of a handsaw and a hammer. So, and where he was able to scrounge the material, I don't know, but he at least got some material. But, tools were left a lot to be. But we did fine.
So,
managed.
Looking back in your timeline again, so you arrived in Khantoum in October.
Yeah.
And,
middle of October.
And so you had to do a little build-up, and then eventually your aircraft showed up. When did that happen?
Well, that was probably a couple of weeks after we got there, so probably into November. Yeah.
And this was where you found your aircraft that had a problem with the flying with the cowling off, and you had to red X it.
Yeah.
And that was back in Pleiku, or was that in a different location?
Oh, it was that they brought them up to us in Khantoum.
Oh.
They brought them. Yeah, from wherever they came in country, I don't know where they offloaded them, and then of course there were a bunch of pilots and Joe and me was flying up there. So half our unit were officers, they were pilots and the like. So with that many aircraft, you've got to have two pilots on each one.
So sometime probably in November they showed up, you had yours red X'd, and they had to take it back and do some work?
Well, no, it was red X'd when I got it in the States.
Oh, okay.
And they rebuilt the engine, and so it was ready to go when it was in the...
Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah.
I wasn't quite track of that. Okay, so when you, so your aircraft arrived, I'm sure you got to do some acceptance checks and things like that. How long from the time they arrive until you guys are ready to do your job?
Oh, we started flying right away. Yeah, we started flying. We moved people around initially from place to place, and usually it was pretty team, you know, this guy needs to go check on that or something. That was the flights that I got. And then I learned, I flew one day like 11 hours, and we came back, and my platoon leader said, you don't have to fly tomorrow. You're going to be here, so you get a chance to clean up your aircraft because it was getting pretty trashy. And then another guy in our unit had a bad helmet. Transferred in, and he had a helmet, and the radio didn't work in it. Of course, they told us never to loan anything, even your bandage, to anybody. But, you know, this guy was flying. He had a pretty hairy mission to do, and he had a helmet. Of course, nobody believed him. Whenever they tested on the ground, it worked fine. Whenever he got in the air, it wouldn't work. He could hear people, but he couldn't communicate. And of course, the crew chief got it. All the time with the pilot when you're flying, because you're the eyes on the side of the aircraft. So I figured I'm not supposed to fly. He was a nice guy, and, you know, I got a good brand new helmet. Take it. So, you know, they told us not to do this, but here. So I gave him my helmet. Well, lo and behold, they were sending me off somewhere else. But before they did that, I was out cleaning the aircraft, because I figured I had the day, and the secretary came out and says, Major wants to know when you can fly. And I said, well, I wasn't supposed to fly today. And, you know, I got to clean things up, get things taken care of here. Well, he wants to know when we're ready to fly. And I said, I don't know. He can tell me when he's ready to fly. You know, I wasn't, you know. So here comes one of the executive officers. He came out. I pretty much told him the same thing the same way. And he said, William, you get down here. How do you address an officer? I went down and saluted him and said, well, sir, this is what I was told. You can do whatever you want to do, you know. And he was a black fellow, but he was good. He had a good mix of blacks and whites in our unit. And the blacks usually dealt with the whites, and the whites usually dealt with the whites. But I got along well with him. Well, William, because we talked a while about some things and how to get stuff done, and if you've got any problems with any of this stuff, I want you to come and talk to me. Talk to the pilot first, and then you come and talk to me. I said, okay, I can do that. And he says, I want you to come in and see me in a little while. So I went in and saw him, and he says, well, we want your aircraft to be the command aircraft, kind of like the old man's driver, only with the aircraft. I says, okay, you know, I didn't figure I must track. I was never iron fatigues fellow. I was just a clean fatigues fellow and took good care of the aircraft. Keep it clean. I didn't like trash, so I would keep it clean. But anyway, so that was kind of my introduction to flying. And we did, you know, flying that day, I actually flew with the first sergeant as the door gunner on the other side. I don't know where they got the weapon or helmet for, because we couldn't get one for this other fellow, but yet they got him one. And I had no way to get that. You know, I was just a T3, and they didn't pay any attention to what you said. So that's what I told the officer. I said, no, they aren't paying attention. He took care of it, and where they got it, I don't know, and why we couldn't get it to this other fellow. Anyway, I got the broken helmet, found out for sure it didn't work. And of course, I heard all the comments when they didn't hear from me. When I was finally, I stood up, just climbed up, because I had that tether that you wore, so you could walk around the aircraft safely. I just got up and walked and said, hey, this helmet's not transmitting. I can hear what you're saying, but you obviously can't hear what I'm saying because of the comments I was getting. And so then we got on the ground and they tried it and worked fine. And I said, well, what can I tell you? Take it and fly with it. And you listen to it. But that was just one of the things. It happened and it worked well. And once I learned to use the right, you know, the system, how to make things work, and it worked really well. But he started to pay attention as an officer said something else.
Did you ever get your helmet back?
Yeah, I did, and it was broken. And of course, I got harassed over that because there was a shield on the front that you had. It was like sunglasses, only it was a shield to protect your face. And that had been lost. He'd done something and tried to adjust it or something, and it fell out, and he lost it. So that was another issue, problem. But, you know, you just, those things that you have to deal with, but it's not a simple solution when you're way off in the middle of nowhere.
The black officer, you said he was the XO. What was his name?
Uh, I can see him, but I don't remember his name. I remembered his name for years, but he was a really nice guy.
Hmm.
I can't tell you right now.
Oh, that's okay. I just thought I'd try and record that. So you're flying. It sounds like they're turning your aircraft into the command aircraft. Did it stay that way for the rest of your tour?
It stayed that way until it got blown to smithereens. I got a picture of it all blown up on January 10th, 1968. It was blown to smithereens when we got attacked. And I went into the history on the 57th Aviation. And the history that I found in that, they don't know what happened to that aircraft. And I thought, I know what happened to that aircraft. I got pictures of that aircraft, but I haven't said anything to anybody. It was totally blown up.
Well, and of course, January 10th was
that's when we were attacked, the first attack that we got on our own compound in the country. And, you know, we flew other places and, you know, came under fire, but that was when the 2 weeks before the Tet happened. And it was a good thing. Actually, it's what saved us during Tet, because we couldn't have handled it if we didn't, because we spent the next 2 weeks fortifying around the Hope perimeter and building bunkers on the corners. And they brought in some troops to be constant guards. And so when we were hit on the Tet offensive, where we had a massing outside our borders, right, we could hold them off. So if we hadn't had that, they would have run over. Question, because our commander was one of the number one in the country on maintenance, and they were running the night crews on the 615th, and that's where all the guys got killed, was out in the maintenance area working on maintenance at night. So,
how many aircraft were destroyed on January 10th?
I'm not exact on that, but I think probably I had pictures of several, so I would say 5 or 6 completely destroyed. Some of them weren't completely. Mine was completely destroyed. All I have a picture of is the tail section. The tail section, the whole body was completely gone. So it's full of fuel. Why you get the fuel cells going, and that's gonna just totally wipe out everything. There were some that were just there was skin was gone. But I just lost 5 or 6 that night, and most of the motor pool was wiped out. And first the generator was blown up that we had for the mess hall and stuff like that. But yeah, they were trying to run a night shift. Of course, they were trying to run the cooks all night too, so people could eat. So, yeah, I had everything all lit up in the wrong places. But,
I guess in the end, then, like you said, the January 10th attack was probably a good, something that I'd probably saved a lot more lives.
Yeah, we lost like 11 that night. And then we had 25 or 30 that were wounded that night. And it only lasted for like 2 hours. It was, the armor from Aberdeen, who was, we were all kids. Guys we were fighting with kids. But the armor shot 2 guys with a pistol that were coming in his reach. And the fellow that was the gunner on the other side of my aircraft, my gunner, He shot two machine guns in between the Nepal and Hooch is where we were. So that was quite an ordeal. And I've got some pictures of that too. I've got pictures of the messed up vehicles, and I've got pictures of some of the ones that were killed. Just kids.
Let me ask you. So your aircraft is destroyed on January 10th. What happens after that? Are you just hot swapping with another aircraft now, or are you in waiting for a replacement?
Well, I didn't do any flying after that. I worked in Cap Smith, who was he was in the unit from the get-go, from the start. He had me working in the kitchen building stuff for him, so I was kept pretty busy there the rest of my tour. And we were fighting a lot. I mean, during Tet, I mean, that's all you did was fight. I mean, we were awake all day and all night for six days straight, day and night. They finally told us after the third day that somebody had to go in and try to get some sleep somewhere, that we couldn't go indefinitely without sleep. But yeah, we were defending ourselves on our own base. We had finally used our own gunships on our own perimeter, which they didn't relish you doing that, but they did, and I guess we had some from other units come too that were doing that. So we'd lost a lot of our equipment, so we were pretty limited as to what we could do, and our maintenance capability was down to zero at that point, because it had been just totally destroyed with the earlier attack. So we were just defending ourselves. We even to the point where during that time we had a C-130 come in and drop ammunition, because we were getting low on ammunition, which is kind of interesting to see them come through, and they come right down on the ground and then they just tip up and let it slide out the back. It does just fine. Go out, get what you needed.
I think they call that a LAPES extraction, where they come down low and there's a chute that pulls the whole pallet out the back and it just goes sliding across the ground.
Yeah.
Well, that would have been exciting to watch.
Oh yeah. Well, and they brought in a tank. I'm not sure where the tank came from, but we constantly were getting rocket fire because we were in a valley, very pretty valley, but we were getting rocket fire from the hills. So they finally brought in a tank, and then the right people would hone that thing in, and that finally cut the rocket fire out once they did that. But they could hone that in on the right side. It slowed that down, so that was kind of interesting too. But we had a field truck, I think it was 173rd, that was going to Dokto. They were coming through, so they had a fuel truck sitting inside of our compound. They brought it inside our compound and parked it for the night. Well, they picked that off in a rocket right away, blew that thing. Unfortunately, it didn't have any fuel in it. Got the truck. So.
Wow. So when you finally had some downtime, I'm just curious. You said you tried to write a letter every week. Did you happen to talk about this, or did you kind of just let that one slide?
I don't remember. I might have said that it's not fun here, but I don't recall I should. My mom saved all the letters, and I've got them, but I don't care to read them. So I don't remember what I might have said some of that to them. But they were reading in the paper. They'd saved the paper what they read about what was going on, and of course, mom had me dead all the time, and I was alive. That's why I kept some of the letters. So in the midst of that, my grandfather died on the day before the Tet Offensive happened, so that was, and of course I didn't find out about, but they knew about that, so he died on the 28th of January, and the Tet Offensive happened the 29th of January, so they had several things going. So.
And I think I read, when I was doing some of your unit research, I think they... Didn't they call your camp Contum, didn't they call that Rocket City at one point?
They probably did. I mean, you got the history of rockets. In fact, I looked at that sheet that you had, which is, each time I get into that, it's different. And some of them have the history from the beginning, and that one didn't. It had it from being in Vietnam, but it listed the rockets that came in, and yeah, they definitely were rockets. And you could hear them for about a minute before they got there. You heard the whistle. You didn't know where it was going to land, but you heard the whistle. So that was just kind of hope for the best when you heard that.
So before you lost your aircraft on the 10th, did you have any extractions that were kind of hostile or at least you thought might be a hostile pickup?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The mission was, our mission, why we got it right away, I don't know, but it was what they call across the fence. So, yeah, we were flying, and before they labeled my aircraft and aircraft while we were flying over in trying to insert some troops down along the trail, and actually it was on a side hill, and the special forces with their expertise and stuff that we were going in to land, and we took on fire then. So we didn't leave these guys. They stayed on board and we took off. So that was the only time I can recall that we ever went straight up, because we had to go straight up. And the thought was we would empty our load and go straight up, and it pulled the machine to the max till we got to the top of the trees, and then we just tipped sideways so we could get out of there. But yeah, we were inserting troops, and they had their full packs, and we had a full load, but we decided it wasn't a good idea to leave them there, so yeah, we pulled them out.
I was reading it was just an Army grunt, and he was talking about the helicopters coming in to pick them up, and he was talking about he would always look at the gunner's face. That was his cue. He would watch the gunner's face for whether this was going to be an easy extraction or a tough extraction.
Yeah. Well, that's because you know where he's seeing something going on. So yeah, that was a smart thing.
I was just curious. Is that something that you tried to not have a look of shock on your face because you didn't want to upset the folks you were picking up, that you just try and keep a neutral expression, or?
No, it's just like looking at a quarterback. You see where he's looking, so you know where he's going to aim that gun, so you don't get shot.
Yeah. I just thought that was an interesting perspective when he said, "Oh, the only thing I looked at once we started running into the clearing was the gunner's face."
Yeah. No, we were just told not you know, usually the pilots would tell us when to fire and not to fire. And they would tell us what we were going into, a live or a safe zone, or what they thought was a safe zone, but you always had your eyes open too. You just didn't want to kill any of your own people.
So the crew chief, as a crew chief position in the aircraft, did you sit behind the pilot or the co-pilot?
Well, a pilot was on the right side, and you sat behind the co-pilot, which would be on the left side.
And then,
probably the only reason they put the crew chief on the left side is he was supposed to be the one to fuel the aircraft, and then the fuel opening was on the left side. That's probably the reasoning for that. I never heard the reasoning, but probably the reason. The door gunner on the other side, you know, kept watch for any other activities or helped the crew chief if they needed to.
And who was the door gunner? Was he another crew chief, or was he just assigned to the aircraft as a gunner?
He was assigned to the aircraft as a gunner. He was an infantry, had an infantry all MOS, or he could have had a 6.7 N20, but it was not necessarily, he was just, could have been an infantry person.
So on January 10th, when you lost your aircraft, and you said you got reassigned to the base, so to base functions, you obviously got to put some of your carpentry skills to work. Is that something that they were just like, hey, where can you pitch in? And you just said, hey, I'm a pretty good carpenter, or did they just tell you, hey, Williams, pick up a hammer and start heading over that way?
They knew that, and how they knew that, I'm not sure. I think they must, you know, you put down all your education and training, so I'm sure Captain Smith, they knew that before they ever left country, that this is who you could call on. I didn't volunteer for that, but I was happy to do it when they asked me to do it. So, that worked. So it was helped them. Probably the most productive thing I did in country was help them make it a little easier on the cooks. So, and it helped for the food too. I mean, I remember when I was working there once, for some reason I helped cook the chicken, and we had this cook that was noted for not cooking the chicken through. He warmed the chicken up and you got it. But I had cooked it a little between one summer, and I learned that you cook stuff through. So he had the recipe for the chicken, which was good, and the right seasoning, but he just needed to cook it a little longer. And so one time I was cooking, and he came and he says, what are you doing to my chicken? He says, I've never gotten comments like this before. And I said, well, I'm just cooking your chicken and making sure that it's cooked through. Well, they sure do like it. Which was kind of, it was a good thing, that was, but,
So you kind of did that the rest of your tour, it sounds like, and so what happened as you started getting closer to the end of the tour? Was the whole unit going to rotate out together?
No. That was the intent of taking, see, some of us, you had to have at least 90 days left in the service to be shipped overseas in a unit. And the idea was then you would get replacements to a unit that had existing personnel. So, no, the whole unit didn't come out, just I. There were several of us that got out that, you know, came from the same class in Fort Eustis that were shipped over with. We were short to go over, actually. And the sad thing is, the guy on the 20, the I don't remember the day, but shortly after that, and it's in the information that you had, Melvin Dye and Griffey were going in on an extraction, and they were shot down and both killed. And Griffey, his bunk was toe-to-toe to mine, and Dye was just down kitty corner. They were both in our unit. That was the one of our units. And they were filling in for somebody else who was sick and couldn't go. So, but they were both killed, and they were both, Dye was to come home in 3 weeks. He was a transfer into our unit, Melvin Dye. And Griffey had gone over in our unit, who had a wife. And so he was only in country a short period of time. And Melvin, who was been in country for nearly a year and was coming home to get married, was killed. And because they were killed across the fence, so to speak, they were listed as missing in action, which they know they were killed because the chase ship saw them get hit where they got hit. And ultimately, only one of them, I guess the pilot only, survived. On that, but they were listing. They're now listed on the wall. I've gone to the wall and seen both of their names on the wall.
It looks like that, if the information I'm looking at with those two, it looks like that was on the 19th of February, 1968.
Yeah.
Does that sound right to you?
Yeah.
So, and where was that? Was that north of your location that happened?
It would have been west of our location.
West.
See, we were really close to the border.
Yeah.
It's not very far from the border.
So, of the Laos border?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, did that crash happen in Vietnam or in Laos?
In Laos.
All right, so that happens, and you're getting ready to pack your bags, it sounds like, just a couple weeks later.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me about how you leave country. I mean, it's the 141 kicked you out the back coming in. What was it like going out?
Well, it was, we were tended to business. We didn't have a lot of time for anything else. We were still getting rocketed, and you know, it started in January, and it didn't really let up. So, you know, those guys that had a full year of that, I can imagine what would have been like. Your nerves are just kind of on edge constantly. I went to play coup, they send you to, like, play clue to transfer out. Well, they didn't send me by helicopter, they sent me by truck, which is 30 miles. And, you know, there had been attacks on that truck, so here you are, right in the back of a deuce and a half. And they tell you, the driver will tell you, I drive like the Dickens, but just hang on, because they're not about to slow down for anything going along road. And, you know, it's a supply truck, and just that was what we had. They probably brought us something on the ground, and he was going back, so that's what they had me go back on. And just we'll drive like the Dickens, and you go and you do it. Spend about a week in play coup processing out the different places you had to go. And they were getting attacked still at that time in Plaku, randomly. It was like in our mess hall, we no longer had mess lines. Usually you always had mess lines, but they finally eliminated the mess lines because it was just a case for snipers to snipe at you. So they had mess hours for longer, and you just went in, and they didn't ever stand in a line. Never wanted to be in a line anyplace. That was the thing. then I went from Pleiku, it flew via Chinook down to Cameron Bay, and you held out there for a couple of days until they got you a flight back to the States. And that was by via commercial airline, and it flew, who was it? I don't remember who it was, but it was a commercial airline. They flew to Hawaii, and then from Hawaii to Fort Lewis, or McCord Air Force Base, and then we processed out there.
So I guess with all the, you know, living in Rocket City and then Pleiku, the situation down there, you never got to see Ann Margaret or Bob Hope.
No, no. No, we didn't have time nor the occasion to see any of that. We didn't have any, you know, in Pleiku, they had a club where you could go and get a beer, and they listened. You know, had music, people coming occasionally, but no, we were kind of an outpost. It was fine. We were busy all the time. We didn't have time to sit around and really think about things a whole lot. And one of the best meals I had was when we flew to Dokto, and that was also when we got the first time I realized you could survive being in a. In the conflict where mortars were coming in. And so we set it out until the mortars quit coming. We were up to check out a C-130 that had been blown up on the end of the runway. And we'd taken somebody up to look at it or do something. And Dokto, as I realize now, was a special forces camp. But you were pretty much kept in the dark about where we were going or what we were doing. We just knew we were going to Dokto. The pilots probably were briefed and knew more, but we did, which I look on it as a good thing and a bad thing, because if you were ever down and by yourself, you wouldn't have a clue where you really were. But then in that country, you don't have a road map and signs to tell you where you're going anyway, so it didn't matter. But, and you always hoped that there was a chase ship coming after you, so happened. But yeah, we didn't get a lot of information. Usually we didn't even know where we were going, other than if it was a relatively safe or could be a live situation. Always expected a live situation, but somewhere more, you know, you are new if you are going into an actively live situation usually before you got.
Once you got on the at Cameron Bay and you got on that aircraft heading home, I can only imagine it was a significantly different environment than the feeling on that 141 going in.
Oh yeah, well, as soon as we lifted off and got up to cruising speed, there was a big hooray that went up. But aside from that, then it was just a good home. And that was a long flight, so, yeah. Well, Cameron Bay, that was the time that Cameron Bay hadn't been hit in months, and they had rocket attacks the night before we landed down there to take off. So, literally got blown out of the country. Yeah. No, it was a big relief. And then after you got home, I can remember being home, and I had written my instructor at the school that I was coming back, and I think I had written him in January that I was going to be back in March, and that he saved me a place in the class so I could finish the course that I had begun, because it was a year cycle. And so when I got home, I checked with him right away, and he said, oh, you take a little time off. He says, you don't need to come back until summertime. So I got back in March, and he says, you start the summer quarter. He says, you've got a good grasp of all the rest of this stuff. You start in the summertime. Give yourself a little break. But while I was at home, there was a fire station kind of up around the corner from where we lived, across the bay and around the corner. Every once in a while, the siren would go off, and when the siren went off, I automatically, you were just hidden under bushes and stuff. It was just a, you know, it took a while to get over that reaction.
I've heard some people say that, you know, a car door slamming or you know, things like that, they were just, you know, unexpected loud noises that, you know, it would take them a few months to sort of settle down from that. Is that kind of the experience you found?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, and certain sounds even now, yeah, just bring it. All of a sudden, it's all right back. All just, yeah, it's amazing how quickly that happens. But, yeah, I got over the siren eventually, and, you know, I'm not hidden for the bushes now. Yeah, it took a few months for that, but even now there's some, they've got, the Indians have some of these loud things that sound just like airbursts, and when I hear one of them, I don't particularly enjoy the 4th of July yet. I just don't. Big flashy things are fine, but a little bit of that goes a long ways. And they have, the Indians have some that are really pretty powerful explosions, and there's some that must have the same sound, because where I live, they just echo down the, there's a water channel here in front of our place, and they just echo down that. For some reason, it's similar to, must be similar to the echo that we had in the valley and where we were. And it just brings a bunch of stuff back that I just cannot remember.
So when you got off that airplane in McCord, mom and dad, brothers and sisters, were they all waiting for you there, or what was the homecoming like?
Uncle Sam didn't allow that at that time. See, we got in, my dad was working at Everett, I think for Boeing at that time, and he had somebody that he knew that was watching my flight come across country. So they knew I landed it. We landed at like midnight. And they asked us before we ever landed, did we want to process out or did we want to sleep and then process out? And they gave us the choice. Well, the choice was process out immediately. And so it was like, I don't know, the afternoon of the next day that I was able to contact my folks, and they came and picked me up at someplace in Fort Lewis. I don't remember where it was, but just some place, some barracks place or someplace, holding area that they had. But once you were a crew, they could come and get it. My dad, mom, and I think one of my little sisters might have been with them. Sure.
What was that like?
Oh, it was just good. It was good to be back. Great to be on terra firma where they weren't shooting at you.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any big homecoming celebrations coming home? Bring a bunch of family in?
No, not that I recall. I just, you know, it was just pretty much got right back to the daily routine. I didn't have a routine at that time, but there was no big celebration. Nowhere. It was kind of, we're just back home. That was fine.
There's been a lot of the folks that we've talked to for this oral history program here that they didn't go back to a base. They were put on a commercial aircraft and got off in like LAX, and they had a lot of protesters, and you know, they had some bad experiences, and you know, usually the local police would have to take them aside before they got off and said, look, there's a lot of people out here that are cause some problems, and I'm just going to warn you right now, if you interact with these people, I'm going to arrest you, not them. And so I was just curious, did you see anything like that in Seattle or in the local area, hear about anything like that?
No, I didn't. I heard about that kind of stuff, and so I, of course, wasn't wearing a uniform, aside from, you know, they issued me a new set of dressing, you know, why, I don't know, because it would have saved the taxpayers money just to let me get out of my fatigue, but whatever. No, I didn't promote that. I saw that on TV. I was probably thankful that I got out in a military base and my parents were able to come and get me, and we didn't have any of that go on. I think they're misdirected. If they're unhappy with something, they ought to go to Washington, D.C. and talk to those people, not the troops that have done what they were asked to do or defending our country. Not their choice and their decision. So I would have no trouble I don't know what I would do with them. I just can't do it more. But the best that I have felt is a Veterans Day event that happened a couple of 3 or 4 years ago, where we had a good they had a good speaker. And he just kind of was a military officer that had something good to say, and included all the branches of service, and that was good. Of course, that was a group of veterans, so it was a kind of a good celebration of appreciation for what they had done, no matter what they had done in the service. And that was kind of the best that I had ever heard since getting out of the service. And that was a formal type ceremony. There have been others that have been not so good. We take our vehicles, Mark and I have, which is my son, have restored some old military vehicles, and we're in it mainly for the vehicles, but we show them at this Veterans Day show. So was good for me one time just to be with other veterans and, you know, that have somebody say something appropriate to us, which was good. Yeah. That was a positive thing.
So you took a little time off and went back to school in the summer?
And then
what happened?
Well, then I went to work. They helped you get your first job after you finish up trade school. So I worked with a contractor over in the Seattle area for about 6 months. And the end of that 6 months, I had met my wife, during that 6 months, I had met my wife, and we got married at the end of that 6 months. And then at the end of that time, which would have been in December of 68 or the first of 69, I started working over on Bainbridge. There was a contractor that was looking for a carpenter, and I worked for him for about 6 years. And then after that, I had gotten, you know, familiar with the whole process, and somebody else, how to work, how things worked in the whole process of building and contracting. And then I started working on my own after that, and then I worked the rest of my career pretty much self-employed, so working as a carpenter.
So you stayed true to your roots. That was what interested you in school, and even through your Vietnam experience, you were able to find use for those skills.
Yeah.
Well, they say if you love what you're doing, you never work a day in your life, right?
That's right. Well, you don't work a day in your life until your body's worn out. Then it becomes work. Your body says, I don't want to do this anymore. And mainly it was, I got arthritis. So it makes it a little more difficult, but I still enjoy it. I missed it when I stopped doing it, telling other people, because you couldn't control your own, it was just hard, to work for somebody and your back hurts pretty bad. You shouldn't be doing that or carrying as much as you carry or being bent over, so your body changes that. Yeah, I still enjoy it. I work with my son some, but it's usually driving a machine for him or something. So you're not putting quite as much stress on your body.
Let me just back up just for a second. So you got married to this young lady during your first stint as working as a contractor in Seattle. And what's her name?
Terry.
Terry. And you had how many kids?
Two. I have a daughter and a son.
What's their names?
Sarah and Mark.
Sarah with an H?
Yeah.
Mark with a K?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, when you got back and you had a certain number of years from your Vietnam experience, and the 60s were kind of a crazy time, even continued into the 70s, what did you think about this whole Vietnam experiment that we had for 10 years?
Well, it really makes me feel bad when I think about all of the lives that were lost for nothing. They essentially turned it back over to them. So I don't know what, I think some of the South Vietnamese people would have been favorable to Americans, but it seems like such a waste to just do all that and have that much time and people lost. Or what happened was what we were trying to prevent, and we didn't prevent it. It ultimately happened, and we lost a lot in the process on both sides. I'm sure those young people that were fighting us thought they were doing right because their government had convinced them to do it. And we thought we were doing right because that's what our government told us to do. And then our government turns over and lets it go to them. So I'm satisfied that I did what I was supposed to do, what I was required to do. Probably to the best that I could have done it. I could have done it better now. Maybe we should have old guys fight rather than young guys. I would do that. But I'm confident that way, but I'm disappointed in the outcome. I was really concerned the first time we went into Iraq, but I thought that went well. And they did a good job, but the second time I thought they had no business going there. And I was concerned about all the people because of the crazy way some of our leaders act.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask you next, looking at Vietnam to where we are with Afghanistan today. Just recently, within the last couple of years, Afghanistan's actually become a longer war than Vietnam has. And so it's just...
Yeah.
I was curious if you left a specialist four, so that was an that's an E-4?
Yeah.
So if you had a young E-4 gunner, crew chief, going in on the Black Hawk in Afghanistan, his first rotation in there, what would be your words of wisdom to pass on to him or her?
Go AWOL. No, I never was that, but boy, make sure you know how to use that weapon, and make sure speak up, I guess. But, you know, speaking up doesn't do any good. That's the sad part. And it's not, it's in a lot of things, speaking up doesn't do any good. But, yeah, you just got to prepare for everything and protect yourself and that, and your friend, and your comrades.
My last question for you, I was just curious, I did see it in your file or anywhere, and that there seems to be a lot of Vietnam veterans that in your year groups that you served during those mid 60 years, that they're actually getting together quite frequently now, that when before they were not. I was just curious, have you found any organizations like that where you've been able to reach out and talk to maybe an old bunkmate or somebody you went through school with, or maybe somebody you flew with a couple of times, or built the chow hall with?
I would like to, and I think that is an age thing. I think you get to this point in life and you go back. I would like to contact or get connected with some of the guys that I spent time building the unit in North Carolina. And I've seen when the initial comments came out about the 57th that I started reading about 10 years ago, or I looked at, was there was a lot of the people that actually built the unit and were, you know, the ones I was together with in Vietnam. So it'd be interesting just to touch bases with them, but, you know, that would take me about 30 minutes and I would have covered everything, so it hardly seems worth it to go. And then now a lot of the information is the later years that have happened, so you really don't have that information. It's a common thing, but it's a bit different than when we first were getting started. But yeah, I would like to contact with some of those, but I just don't see that happening. I've only talked or met one other crew chief since I've gotten out in all my years. I've been out over 40 years, and he actually goes to church where I go to church now. But he was much more aggressive than I was, and he doesn't seem to want to talk about it, so I don't talk with him much. And I had the guy that was my door gunner on the other side. He actually did that full tour, and then did another tour in Vietnam. And he came and saw me, but he left me his number, but I haven't been able to connect with him since. But I would like to connect with him. He was supposed to have lived over in Richmond, but I would like to connect with him. And I may try to do that too, try to search him, see if I can find him.
Okay, I lied. I said that was going to be my last question. I've got one more.
okay.
If I was actually flipping through your questionnaire here real quick, and I had that one question towards the end, and I'm struggling to find it right now. But if there's a lot of folks that have gone back to Vietnam just to visit, and I think you indicated that yeah, you might be interested in that. If you were to do that, where would you go? Would you go up to Con Tum?
Oh, that's where I would want to go. Yeah, I would want to go and see if I could see that place where I was. Yeah. And again, that would take me, you know, I would see it, spend probably 15 minutes there and leave. So realistically, it doesn't. But yeah, would I like to see it again? Yes. I thought I was very fortunate in my whole tour, actually, to be in the highlands versus down in the Delta or on the DMZ in the north. Why, I thought the Central Islands was a lot like the Northwest here. It was hills and valleys and very pretty country. And I had a lot of empathy for the people. I felt so bad. when I left, I got to come and go away, and those poor people had to stay there. You know, the South Vietnamese people, I just felt so bad for them because it's just really nerve-wracking, you know. You know, and they just shot up the whole town. I mean, yeah, that was something else. I guess that's why I don't like the 4th of July, because the night of the 10th when it happened, I mean, you had, it sounded like firecrackers, and you knew it was rifle fire going in town. They were just killing everybody. Yeah, I felt so bad for those people, and I still would. I worked down in Katrina. After Katrina, it was about 6 months. I was down there with Presbyterian Disaster Assistance, and one of the homes that we worked on was from a Vietnamese family, Papa Son, and the mama, actually it was her dad and the daughter, and her son were Vietnamese, and they had come to Biloxi, getting out of the country. But that was kind of interesting, and that was a good thing. That was a good thing, to be able to connect with them a bit. They knew where Kantu, she was, his mother, the son, of course, was raised in this country, but the mother knew Kantu, and the grandfather, who didn't speak any English at all yet, I'm sure knew where Kantu was. And they appreciated that I had been there.
All right. Well, David, I didn't think we were going to go through this whole, your whole thing in just slightly over 2 hours, but it looks like we did.
Yeah, I think that's good.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to turn the recording off. Before I do that, though, I want to say one more time, thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to pass this information and talk a little bit about your Vietnam experience.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome. I was glad to do it with you.